WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
My way over. Wondering I am lost.
That's not our usual theme. That's Many Rivers to Cross. And why? Well, it is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And we always do have many rivers to cross. But we are very pleased to welcome back now Dr. Henry Louis Gates, historian, genealogist, African and African American studies professor at Harvard, movie consultant to 12 Years a Slave, editor-in-chief of The Root, and producer of a new six-part PBS series that begins tonight called The African Americans' Many Rivers to Cross. Dr. Gates, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. And it's so great to see you again.
And this time in our studio. I think we did our last few on the phone, so it's great to see you again. And are people going to hear that particular music in the series?
Oh, they will. That's the theme song.
That's your theme.
You know, and I actually talked to Jimmy Cliff the other day, and he said he'd been following my work. He's been my hero since I went to graduate school in England at Cambridge in 1973, and I saw The Harder They Come. Did you ever see The Harder They Come?
Yeah.
And I fell in love with it. So when we were looking for a theme for the series, I wanted the theme of rivers, and everyone uses Langston Hughes's poem, I've Known Rivers. And I wanted something different, and I said, why not use Jimmy Cliff, because it's really Pan-African. It crosses boundaries and borders, and it's so lyrical.
Before we get too much into the series, I want to ask you first about 12 Years a Slave, since it is getting such rave reviews and strong audience reactions, and some of our listeners have seen it by now. What role did you play in reviewing the script?
Well, I was the, well, what the credits call the historical consultant, but basically I was a fact checker. I read the script. I had a long session on the phone with Steve McQueen. A friend of mine emailed me and said, Steve McQueen, I thought he was dead. I said, no, that's a white Steve McQueen. This is the black British director of Shame and Hunger, Steve McQueen, who's a genius. And then at various points I was called into to check facts. In particular, have you seen the film yet?
Not yet.
Well, at the end, there's text on the screen, and I dictated that the text about what happened to Solomon Northup.
You're not going to do a spoiler now. You know, our listeners were very upset last week when Michael Eisner was here, and in making an unrelated point, he accidentally gave away the ending to Gravity.
Oh, my God. No, I saw Gravity. It's interesting, and I won't give it away. And I won't give away the ending or the plot of Solomon Northup. But so I was actively involved.
And did you make any changes?
No. There was nothing to change. They followed,
because you had edited a version of his manuscript, right?
I do a series for
and
Penguin.
I don't mean the screenwriter's manuscript, the actual manuscript of the book from the 1800s.
Yeah, you know Penguin Classics when you were in college. Well, I have a series that I edit on Penguin's African American Classics, and Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave is one of the titles in that series, with an introduction by the great historian Ira Berlin. So John Ridley, who's an African-American screenwriter, followed the text of Solomon Northup almost exactly. They made a few changes, but I'm not the kind of scholar who confuses a feature film with documentary. You know, this he has to take liberties, and he took some liberties, but nothing that interfered with the veracity of the text.
You know, more than one review has called it the best movie ever made about slavery. Do you think it is?
Yeah, I would say, I would qualify it slightly to say I think that there are two brilliant movies about slavery. One was Django, and the other is 12 Years a Slave. But I would put them at the opposite ends of the pole of representation. Django is the best postmodern spaghetti Western slave narrative, and in fact, it's the only one.
Really, there's a genre. Postmodern spaghetti Western about slavery.
Yeah, but 12 Years a Slave is the best modernist realist portrayal. It's the best take on what it was like to be a slave and the peculiarities. You know what the best thing about this movie is? In addition to Chiwetel's, Ejiofor's masterful portrayal of Solomon, it's Michael Fassbender's portrayal of the third master, Edwin Epps, who's a sadist. But what's curious about it is that rather than render him as a cartoon, as a one-dimensional evil Simon Legree, as Harriet Beecher Stowe did in Uncle Tom's Cabin, he's three-dimensional. He's in love with this slave named Patsy, and he hates himself for loving her, and he doesn't know how to process that love, so he beats her. I mean, he beats her in the most sadistic ways. And that's interesting. I've never seen a rendering of how slavery perverts the master as well as demeans and dehumanizes the slave.
Which gets to some of the things that I've been hearing and reading about the audience experience of seeing the film, which is that great and important as 12 Years a Slave might be, it can also be very hard to watch.
Well, imagine how much harder it was to experience.
Well, no kidding. But one article on your magazine, The Root, today has the headline, 12 Years a Slave Was Too Much by Demetria Lucas. And it's not a criticism of the film, hardly, but the reality of the experience for her and many black filmgoers that she references when a tough, honest movie like this comes out about the black experience. It's not popcorn fare, but rather an emotionally brutal experience that can take days to recover from. You think that's a widely shared reaction?
Oh, I think so. I had a screening on Martha's Vineyard this summer. Friends came. Alan Dershowitz came, actually, and Alan sent me an email afterwards and said, this is the African-American Schindler's List. So that begins to put it in perspective. Yeah. And my own daughter, who's going to be a producer, brilliant filmmaker, works with Tanya Lee, Spike's wife, as a matter of fact. She sat through that screening, and then I did another screening. She started, and she said, Daddy, I just can't, it's too much. It's too much just to think about the suffering of our people. And I want Americans and people around the world to understand the reality of slavery and not the papered over carnival version that you see in Gone with the Wind type movies.
People are starting to call in. I hadn't even given out the phone number yet, but some people know it. So if you want to talk to Dr. Henry Louis Gates, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe for these first few minutes, if you've seen 12 Years a Slave, but anything, we'll do a robust Ask Dr. Gates a little later in the hour. Everything you always wanted to ask Henry Louis Gates, but you didn't happen to have him over for dinner. 212-433-9692. I noticed that one article on The Root compiled a list of what they called the 12 best and worst films about slavery. And maybe the worst was a 1975 movie starring the boxer Ken Norton called Mandingo.
Yeah.
That was all murder and affairs and revenge with a touch of sort of supernatural creepiness even. Roger Ebert reviewed it at the time as, quote, a piece of manure.
That was all about his bare chest, I think, and the titillation of interracial sex, as I remember it. But it was famous. It's often referenced.
And as The Root points out, incredibly, Mandingo had a sequel called Drum, also with Ken Norton in 1976, which also makes their worst list. Yeah. Do you have any worst slavery movies of all time?
I think that Gone with the Wind, it did more damage to the American people's understanding of the realities of slavery than any other single film except for Birth of a Nation. So the all-time worst film about slavery and Reconstruction, of course, is Birth of a Nation. But you can't even laugh about it. It was evil, pure evil. It's often remembered as cinematically brilliant for the techniques introduced, depth of field, point of view. But it was part and parcel of dismantling all the progress that black people had made in the period of Reconstruction, and it coincided with the introduction of Jim Crow de jure segregation, which really starts in about 1890. And it accompanied a proliferation through chromolithography of tens of thousands, millions really, of four-color images of black people as coons and mammies and sambos and chicken-stealing, watermelon-eating, people who only speak in malaprops and therefore are intellectually deficient. So it was a pernicious bit of business, and even our president, Woodrow Wilson, showed it at the White House and declared that it was history writ with lightning. So that's the all-time worst. And Gone with the Wind, for as much as I liked Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara, it was quite demeaning and perverting when it came to a genuine understanding of what our people experienced, suffered through, and overcame as slaves.
And do you think that the two movies were bad in those ways, in a way that kind of replicates different kinds of racism in society? Like with Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith had an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of racism is unintentional, or a lot of discrimination is not necessarily because I'm going to hold those black people down, but things that people don't get.
Yeah.
Was Gone with the Wind more like that?
Yeah, we could call it romantic racialism. Now, that's a term that George Frederickson coined in another context, but we can say that romantic racism, the ultimate example of that is Gone with the Wind. I don't think anyone set out to demean the slaves. In fact, they gave the woman who played Mammy, of course, an Academy Award.
Yeah.
And she was loving and da-da-da. So it's an unwitting way to perpetuate stereotypes, or a witting way to perpetuate unsavory stereotypes.
I want to take our first call. Put your headphones
sure.
on, and we're going to talk to Earl in Teaneck, earlier on WNYC with Henry Louis Gates. Hi, Earl.
Hi, fantastic show, and it's always a pleasure to listen to, and what a pleasure to speak with Professor Gates. The question I have is sort of an adjunctive to what you're discussing, and that is, there's a tremendous amount of information and research going on about the slave trade going west with the Europeans in America, but I don't really hear much about the slave trade that took place out of East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That went on for centuries, even into the 20th century. And from what little information I could get, the slave trade going east was as extensive as the slave trade going west.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious. I understand that tremendous number of slaves from the Arab traders, the Indian immigrants in Kenya, etc., were conducting this well into the 20th century. So I'd be very interested to see what information Professor Gates has for
Earl,
about
thank
that.
You very much. And I think this goes right to episode one of your PBS series, which debuts tonight, episode one covering 1500 to 1800.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But, Earl, you're absolutely correct. In fact, you should add the trans-Saharan slave trade, the trade that crossed the Sahara Desert. And one scholar estimates that 12.5 million Africans were shipped from south to north across the Sahara Desert and through the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, which is exactly the figure that David Eltis and his colleagues have counted by examining the shipping records of 36,000 voyages of slave ships from Africa to the New World. So, but no one talks about it. Part of the problem, Earl, is that it's only an estimate because there weren't records, unlike the transatlantic slave trade, which was detailed in terms of record keeping.
So we're going to take a break here, and then we're going to continue with Dr. Henry Louis Gates, historian, genealogist, African and African American studies professor at Harvard, movie consultant to 12 Years a Slave, editor-in-chief of The Root, and producer of the new six-part PBS series that begins tonight called The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. And, yes, it's Ask Dr. Gates anything you've always wanted to ask the scholar and inspiration to many but didn't happen to have him over for dinner. Actually, our lines are full, so hang on, folks. And when people finish up, we'll get some more of you in. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue now with Dr. Henry Louis Gates, historian, genealogist, African and African American studies professor at Harvard, movie consultant to 12 Years a Slave, editor-in-chief of The Root, and producer of the new six-part PBS series that begins tonight at 8 on Channel 13 called The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. And we're going to do Ask Dr. Gates in just a second. Our lines are full. So thank you for your patience, and we'll get right to you at 212-433-9692. I just want to ask you about the period that you cover in the series tonight, mm-hmm. part one, 1500 to 1800, which we touched on a little bit before the break. But it strikes me that there's such a contradiction in that period in European history, which is often referred to as the Renaissance or the Age of Enlightenment, that Europe was simultaneously coming out of the intellectual dark ages with the explosion of science and literature and democracy and rights movements here and elsewhere, and an embrace of rational thought at the same time as expanding the transatlantic slave trade to its fullest, most horrifying form. Do you ask yourself, do you ask in the episode tonight, how could those two things have been happening in humanity at the same time?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Goya's famous aphorism, the dream of reason breeds monsters. And that's what happened. The Renaissance was accompanied by, you know, great, or it was enabled by great economic prosperity. And it led to, part of that was certain technological advances, which made it possible to sail ships longer and in different directions. And part of that led to the circumnavigation of Africa, the ultimate, quote unquote, discovery of the New World, the introduction of new crops, the expansion of sugar. Sugar was like crack. And before sugar was cultivated in the New World, it was an elite consumer good. And all of a sudden, it could be grown at an unprecedented rate and to an extent, and that and needed bodies.
And the invention of the cotton gin.
Cotton gin is after the 1790s, but going back to the first cause of the slave trade was sugar. And it led to the exploitation of black bodies on the African continent by the European sea powers.
Does tonight's episode, which I haven't seen yet, also touch on that less remembered revolution near our shores, the Haitian Revolution in 1800, which ended slavery there?
Oh, absolutely. We say that this is a series about roots, R-O-O-T-S, but also about roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. People forget how small the distances were, even then. Now, of course, they're much shorter.
Yeah, fly for 45 minutes.
Yeah, but 50 miles separates Cuba and Haiti, for example. So what happened in Haiti had direct impact on what was happening in the slave community in the United States. So I'll give you an example. We talk about the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina in 1739, the bloodiest rebellion of in the 18th century among the slaves. And why did those guys rebel? They were trying to get to Florida. Why were they trying to get to Florida? Because the King of Spain in 1693 had issued an edict saying any of the slaves in the British colonies, meaning Carolina and Georgia, who crossed the St. Mary's River into Florida would be free if they did three things: pledge fealty to the throne, join the Roman Catholic Church, and agree to serve in the militia. And, Brian, so many slaves fled to Florida that they formed a free black community, Fort Mosey, 2 miles north of St. Augustine. This is a history that we tell no one is told in a documentary series, including the first African-American, as I call him, the brother who came to Florida in 1513 named Juan Garrido. He wasn't even a slave. He was a black conquistador and came with Ponce de Leon in search of the Fountain of Youth, just like the white guys. It's amazing.
A black conquistador from Spain via Africa.
Yeah, that's right. He was born in Africa in 1480, went to Spain. Spain had and Portugal had a large black community because they had slaves there too. And so this is a century and 9 years before Jamestown.
Did he leave a diary with his identity confusion?
He left a petition that he sent to the king for a pension. And in this petition from 1538, he makes the most extravagant claim. He says, "My lord, I was the first person to sow wheat in the New World." Now, as I said to Tavis Smiley the other night, you know he was a brother just by making that claim. "I've invented wheat, Your Honor, Your Majesty."
All right. Now it's Ask Dr. Gates. Anything you've always wanted to ask the scholar and inspiration to many, but you didn't happen to have him over for dinner. Our lines are full, so when people finish up, 212-433-WNYC. Thaddeus in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, Thaddeus.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead. You're on with Dr. Gates.
Hey, Thaddeus.
Dr. Gates, I've been following you for a number of years, and I would like to see more positive images of Black Americans. I don't like the term African American. I was born in North Carolina, mm-hmm. and I prefer the term Black American.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see more positive images of Black Americans instead of this constant stories about slavery and brutality. All right, everyone knows about slavery. We know we were brutalized. We know we were slaves. We need to learn. Our children, especially, need to learn about Black inventors. All these things that we now use every day. The traffic light was invented by a Black man, and we never hear anything about that. The only thing we hear about is slavery. You know, we need to hear more things about that. And you being a historian, I would hope, since you're affiliated with PBS, that you would do more of that.
Okay.
Let's get a response. And I know there are a lot of individual profiles in this series.
Sure.
Again, I haven't seen, but from what I've read, it's both.
Yeah, we do both things. You have to talk about slavery. I mean, we didn't come here on the Mayflower. We didn't come here voluntarily, our ancestors. We had to say how we got here. And then we talk about how we evolved. And the transcendence by the Black community over the evil confines of slavery is one of the greatest and most noble stories in the history of civilization. So we have to tell that story. But along the way, we tell the stories of great inventors. People like Benjamin Banneker, who wrote one of the first almanacs and invented one of the first clocks in the New World, and who corresponded with Thomas Jefferson. And as you were talking about Garrett Morgan and other inventors like that, and we absolutely do both things. We believe that there should be positive images, but we can't only tell part of the story, my brother. We have to tell a full rounded story. And there are many heroes in the tradition whom we celebrate, and I hope you'll see that tonight, starting with Juan Garrido, who was a real hero, and the second African-American who was a slave named Esteban, who saw more of continental United States as an explorer than anybody before the time of Lewis and Clark. So that's how we start the series, and I hope you'll call in, let Brian know what you think.
Thaddeus, please do. And let's go on to Tanya in Hazlitt, who saw 12 Years a Slave. Hi, Tanya.
Hi. I had intended, actually, when I first read about the movie, I said, oh, this sounds good. And I had actually thought that I would take my 12-year-old son with me, and thank goodness I did not take him. I feel that it would be too much. I do think it's something that, as a teenager, will be something for him to see. I went with a friend. She said, oh, let's go. I said, okay, fine. We went to the movie, and it is most certainly not a popcorn movie because the popcorn sort of sat there, and my friend, who was all hot to go, said, you know, I don't think I can take this. And I said, you're going to shut up, and you're going to watch it, and you're going to see it. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting about it was the fact that like, I can remember back in the days, Eddie Murphy used to have his joke about, oh, how come the people didn't just slap Massa and this, that, and the other. It very vividly showed what would happen, and I thought that it was very relatable even to me in this time period. I could relate to Solomon, to what he was going through, because it was something that he had no knowledge of. And I just thought that it was something that was very well done. And I also have to say, Dr. Gates, that I do love your programs, and you are already on my DVR, and my 12-year-old will be watching that with me.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. But you're absolutely right. The scenes of sadism between Edwin Epps and Patsy, the woman he loves and hates, or hates himself, are very, very difficult to take. And so I would, if I were a parent, a parent's listening, you'd look at a preview or think about when your child should see it.
What age do you think?
I don't know. It depends on the 12-year-old. Because when I did screening, some 12-year-olds were there. They seemed to deal with it. But I don't know if I could have handled it when I was 12 years old to see a naked Black woman being beaten. And they show the stripes so vividly. the mode of torture so vividly that it's difficult for an adult. I'm 63, and it was hard to think.
Gail in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gail. You also saw the film.
Hi,
you're also
Brian,
calling about the movie.
Greenwich Village. Long
time Greenwich Village. Hi, Gail. Greenwich, yeah, Greenwich Village. What's the difference, really?
I saw the movie at Union Square the day that it opened, and I was one of very few non-African Americans in the audience that day. But I assure you, and I want to clarify this for Professor Gates, who I have the ultimate respect for. When we were in the women's room, we were all crying, mm-hmm. all of us, mm-hmm. every single one of us, embracing and crying, black, white, together.
Mm-hmm.
The other point, and unrelated, is my son at dinner the other night, after we were all talking about the movie, said that had not Uncle Tom's Cabin come out about the same time, that 12 Years a Slave would have been the book that Uncle Tom's Cabin became.
Your son said that?
In terms of popularity and readability.
Your son said that?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, your son's absolutely right. Do you know that 12 Years a Slave, Uncle Tom's Cabin was published in 1852. 12 Years a Slave was published in 1853. It was dedicated to Harriet Beecher Stowe. So your son's absolutely right. And it sold more copies than Frederick Douglass's slave narrative. It sold 11,000 copies in the first month, and it sold 30,000 copies in the next 2 years. It was an extraordinarily successful bestseller.
Vaughn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Vaughn.
Good morning, gentlemen. Nice to speak with you both.
Hey,
my
Vaughn.
Point, question to Dr. Gates is, a couple of days ago I read in the New York Times that 14 Caribbean nations have filed suit against Britain for reparations on slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And it also ties into earlier this year, there was a big article the BBC did on the fact that Britain rewarded slave owners with millions of pounds. Back then, I guess today it would be billions of dollars,
mm-hmm.
because slavery was abolished and they lost their slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Would you speak to that, please?
Well, and there's one more case recently. The British agreed to pay compensation for victims of genocide from Mau Mau in Kenya. So there are a lot of precedents. Do I think that the American people, the American Congress, is ready to give reparations to the sons and daughters, the grandchildren of slaves? Absolutely not. But, I mean, you can look at the Tea Party and its reaction to Barack Obama. I just don't see that on the horizon. I wrote a piece that was very controversial in the New York Times, though, my brother, a few years ago, Brian remembers, in which I said, well, maybe we should also talk about reparations from African governments to African Americans, since, according to John Thornton and Linda Haywood at BU, 90% of all of our ancestors shipped to the New World were captured by Africans from Africans. You know, we had this
And
naive.
Boy, did you get blowback for that.
Oh, my God, like Hurricane Sandy. But it's just the truth, and I'm a scholar. I have to tell the truth. We were raised with the image, Brian, that white people were hiding in the bushes and our ancestors were out for a picnic on Sunday like in Roots and threw a net over them. No, they were captured as a result of wars, sometimes judicial proceedings, sentenced people who were in debt and adulterers into slavery. And then, of course, there were black kidnappers who just kidnapped and then sold to Europeans along the coast. The Europeans didn't even penetrate the interior until the 19th century. So they were in forts or factories, they were called, or sometimes just on ships waiting for African elites to bring their captives to the coast, and then they were shipped to the New World. So the matter of reparations is a vexed and complex one.
One more break, then we'll continue with Dr. Gates. More of Ask Henry Louis Gates. You can keep holding if you're waiting to talk to him. We haven't even brought up your genealogy work yet, which has been so inspiring to so many people. And I'm going to want to know how it relates to what's going on PBS tonight with some of the personal stories there. And maybe people will want to bring that up. I know people have used the model that you've put out there on television to search for their own roots. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we wrap up our full hour with Dr. Henry Louis Gates, historian, genealogist, African and African American studies professor at Harvard, movie consultant to 12 Years a Slave, editor-in-chief of The Root, and producer of a new six-part PBS series that begins tonight called The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. And Robert in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC with Dr. Gates. Hi, Robert.
Hello. I'm so glad I got a chance to get on. Dr. Gates, hello. Hi. Are you?
How are you doing, Robert? Hope you're watching the program tonight at 8 o'clock.
Oh, I will. I've been trying to get to you for years.
Oh, this is your lucky day.
Yes, it is. It is, because I just have a quick question. I've hit a wall. I'm doing a search on my family and my father, and because my father was killed in Boston area.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I never really got to know him, but I got to know who he was, that kind of thing. I have his birth certificate, his death certificate. Mm-hmm. He spent time there and trying to find my grandfather. Also, he was in New Orleans, up to Massachusetts. And he also was down in the vineyard for a while.
And so the question is how to do the genealogy? Or this is about your father. You know where you came from.
Right. I've done a lot of research, but it's at a brick wall now. And through Ancestry, Salvation Army, Social Security, I got a Social Security number, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that all of the people that are asking to help me with this want astronomical money. They want, like, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000.
Okay. Well, I could tell you two places that you can go for free to get advice. The New England Genealogical Society on Newberry Street and the New York Genealogical Society. I'm on the boards of both. You can tell them I sent you. You can just call them, then go to see them, and they will give you assistance.
Say the names of those places again.
The New England Genealogical and Historic Society on Newberry Street in Boston, and the New York Genealogical Society right here in Midtown Manhattan.
When I Googled, and good luck, thank you for calling. I see he's already gone, so he's probably calling them already right now. When I Googled Henry Louis Gates genealogy this morning, preparing for this interview, I noticed that along with the search results, I got ads for 23andMe, the company that sells personal genetic profiles. But usually we hear about that in terms of finding out your risk of disease and things like that. Does it have an application in discovering where you came from?
What, 23andMe?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We use several companies. Excuse me. For all of our guests in finding your roots, we use 23andMe. We use Ancestry DNA. We use Family Tree DNA. And for African Americans, we use AfricanAncestry.com. And they're all excellent. And 23andMe particularly focuses on risk for certain genetic diseases.
Mark on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Brian. Dr. Gates, it's a pleasure to talk to you also.
Hey, Mark.
I had a question and an observation. First, I'll start with the question. Do you think that affirmative action is a type of a backdoor way of admitting to some kind of reparation, and if more people viewed it that way, would it have an easier time of it these days?
Since we were talking earlier about reparations,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And my observation is I have a friend of mine whose ancestor was a Dutch pirate who converted to Islam in the 1600s, and his main slave trade were the Irish, who were actually cheaper than the African slaves, and therefore more valued because their lives were worth less.
Huh. Do you think that that's historically accurate, that last part?
I don't know about the Irish were subjugated. The Dutch, there's no question that the Dutch played a major role in the slave trade in the early 1600s, in the golden age of Holland. But I don't know about the Irish being used as slaves. But I'll do some research about that. But in terms of affirmative action as a form of reparation, absolutely. I think that's a brilliant suggestion, and I think that people should see it that way. But I also think that we need affirmative action for poor white people as well. I think an economic element, a need-based element should be included, because affirmative action for my generation, and remember, I went to Yale because of affirmative action in 1969, it was a class escalator. And more often than not today, or often at places like Harvard, Yale, those kind of schools. It seems to be a way to perpetuate your own class position. I want to see more poor people entering the middle class using affirmative action in the same way that our generation did 40 years ago.
You told Salon in an interview that we can't have a meaningful national conversation about race if we use the term a national conversation about race.
That's right.
Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think that where do we really have conversations about citizenship? In our schools. But your teacher, Brian, never said to you when you were in first grade, today we're going to have a conversation about citizenship. She said, today we're going to learn my country tis of thee, I pledge allegiance to the flag, America the beautiful. It was done osmotically. And that's what we have to do with race and the history of racism and the history of people of African descent. Our story has to be integrated inextricably with the story of America, not only George Washington, but Harry Washington. Harry Washington, George Washington, and slave, ran away from Master Washington, joined the not the Patriots, but the British Loyalists. And then when the British lost, was expatriated to Nova Scotia and then to Sierra Leone. That tells a fuller story about American history.
And not just when there's a section on slavery.
That's right.
But then,
Day. Like back in my school days, we had one day. We called it Slavery Day. And all the black kids would just lower themselves down in the desk because it was so embarrassing when the teacher said, basically, your ancestors were swinging from trees until we saved you and educated you at the school of slavery. You know, it was pretty bad.
Are you not a fan of Black History Month because it isolates it?
No, I love Black History Month, but I want every day to be Black History Month in our school system. And that's why I did the African Americans Many Rivers to Cross, which airs tonight at 8 o'clock.
And as we run out of time, in 1 minute from now, we do say that the PBS series, The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross, is a six-part series that's going to air. Is it going to be Monday nights for 6 weeks, or how are you going to do
Tuesday
that?
Tuesday.
Hello, what day is it? Tuesday nights at 8 on Channel 13, part one tonight, 1500 to 1800. And we have the trailer for those of you who can't wait up on our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can see the trailer for the series. And Dr. Henry Louis Gates, always great to talk to you. Thank you for coming in and sharing so much with us.
Thanks for having me on your wonderful program.
And thanks to all of you for your calls. I apologize to those of you whose calls for Dr. Gates we couldn't get to. Tune in again tomorrow for the Brian Lehrer Show. Talk to you at 10 o'clock.